If you have your own story of being in a cult or a high control group,
or if you've had experience with manipulation or abuse of power that you'd like to share,
leave us a message on our hotline number at 347-86-TRUST.
That's 347-868-7878.
Or shoot us an email at trustmepod@gmail.com.
Trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
If you think that one person has all the answers, don't! Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cults, extreme belief, and manipulation from two friends who've actually experienced it. I am Lola Blanc.
And I'm Megan Elizabeth.
And today is part two of our interview with Jan Broberg, kidnapping survivor and subject of the Peacock documentary Friend of the Family, True Evil, plus the scripted series that accompanies it, Friend of the Family. She's going to talk about how Robert Birchtold continued to seduce her mother to get to Jan, and about the second time he abducted Jan from her family, keeping her hidden for several months in Southern California.
She'll tell us about how brainwashed she was even after she was returned home, how Birchtold continued to try to intimidate her family, and the moments that helped her realize he'd been lying to her the whole time.
Yeah, she will. You know, those are some of the most interesting parts of every story. I always want to know, like, what were the things that kind of like made you realize? What were the straws that broke the camel's back, you know? And I do think hers are really interesting.
I mean, yeah, there is that beautiful one moment in here when it kind of all collapses all at once, which is my favorite kind of story.
I love a good collapse.
Me too, especially when it's the collapse of a negative belief system.
Exactly. Heads up, y'all. We will be talking about abuse of a child as well as a mother, sexual abuse and otherwise. So just take note of that before you decide to listen. And before we dive in, Megan, I have to ask you this extremely important question, which is, what's the coolest thing that happened to you this week?
Okay, well, I've been following the Danny Masterson trial. I've brought it up a couple times on here. More interesting stuff. This time, they are saying that Lisa Marie Presley asked a couple of the victims to stay quiet because she, as we know, is a Scientologist, Lisa Marie is, and they kind of send out the big guns when somebody is accusing people in the church of sexual harassment. And it sounds like that she not only admits that she did that, but she also contacted one of the girls and said that she was sorry about doing it.
No way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I appreciate that part of it, at least. So what's the latest? Is she she's talking openly about it, like saying she did it?
I just saw that it was put as evidence in the trial. She was not one of the witnesses called forth, but that was just like open knowledge that she did this.
Right, right.
Apologized and all of that. And then I also saw that there's like a tied jury or something. So the judge sent them home for like 10 days of deliberation over Thanksgiving. So hopefully he does not get off scot-free, but we shall see.
Jury rooms are very interesting to me and a little concerning often.
Very. Yeah, we'll have to see what happens after Thanksgiving break because I do believe they are in deliberation.
They're still in deliberation. So yeah. So hung jury is when they actually fully cannot come to a conclusion. And right now we are waiting to find out. Okay, very interesting. TBC.
Yep, we'll see.
TBD.
We will see. What about you?
Oh, you know, do you ever have these periods where, I feel like this happens to me like twice a year, where you are sick of all of the shit that's already in your brain in terms of like you, the things that you like and your thoughts and your ways of seeing the world and like the art that you like? Do you ever just like get sick of it and you're like, ugh, I need like something new?
Yeah.
Like I need to have a new thought or like a new framework or like
personality. I think that's when usually people have children. They're like, I cannot be fully focused on myself anymore. I'm terrible. Yes, I've been there many times.
Well, it's just like sometimes I'll feel like I am not growing enough. I'm like, I need like more growth and I don't know how, but like almost like spiritually or something where it's like, okay, yeah, I'm doing my art. Yeah, I'm in my relationship and I'm happy in that. And I'm like living a good life, but I feel like I just need more meaning and I need more like philosophies or something like more.
Sounds like time for your UFO cult to begin.
Exactly. Well, that all is to say, this would be the perfect time to target me for your cult, you guys, because I'm like, give me some meaning.
Yeah.
I want to like feel something.
Give me some peak experiences or even sad experiences over the existential death of nothing. Kind of.
Yeah. I mean, like,
you just start crying. You're like, yeah.
I feel like I don't need more sadness. So maybe it's not that. It's more like I'm like hungry for just growth and newness and meaning.
Yeah.
If anyone has recommendations, I literally like sometimes it comes from a book or a poem or it can come from anything. I just like haven't had something that's really like gotten me feeling stimulated lately.
Have you tried the Catholic Church?
No, and I don't intend to. Great idea, though. Cool. So anyway, I'm available for whatever cult you got. I'm here.
All right.
And then I'll talk about it on the show and roast you.
Yeah, reach out if you have any ideas of where Lola can hide.
I think it's activism. I think I just need to like do things for other people. That might be what I need. Anyway, should we talk to Jan?
I want to. Let's do it.
Okay.
So you get back to your normal life. You're getting notes still. You're like, oh, the alien thing is still on. Hasn't gone away. I still have a mission. And is this between part where he again seduces your mother?
Yes. Yeah. And that happens early on. So the seduction where it actually went, you know, past the line that, you know, my mother, until she was watching the series, I think finally had that moment of, oh, well, it's clear to me why I did this, you know, because she's beat herself up her whole life. Mm. What happens is he's calling every day, and you don't have a cell phone to screen your calls. It rings on your wall and you pick it up, and there he is on the other end of the phone. Marianne, please don't hang up. I want to tell you everything of what happened and why this thing with Jan got out of control. And I have he has an answer for everything. So eventually, after being asked, you know, 50 times, she finally agrees to go meet him. And she goes to meet him, and he's going to tell her all the reasons and how much he's been in love with her since day one. And it's all about you, Marianne. I've only wanted you. You're the person I've been dreaming about to have the life that I've always wanted. And I just know you're so dedicated to Bob and your girls, but Bob doesn't deserve you. Please bring the girls and come down here. I'll get you an apartment, and you know, all these things. And then of course, playing upon all of her emotions and her feelings and her attraction to him. And eventually, after a couple of these encounters, they have an affair. They you know, sleep together. And she said, over the course of about 6 months, I probably met up with him 8 or 9 times, but really only had that full experience about three to four times. At least that's what her recollection is. I'm not sure that it's the right number that's in whatever she finally testified to in court, but that's her recollection.
You mean having a sexual relationship with him 3 or 4 times? Okay. Okay. Right. Got it.
And so it's just that I really was trying to find answers. And then a few things that happened, this is early on. And again, before the hearing, before he's basically sentenced to 5 years, but then it's all, you know, reduced to a 45-day sentence. And he'd spent 30 days in jail in Mexico and Arizona before he was, you know, extradited back to Pocatello. So only 15 days was exactly what he had to serve for that first kidnapping. And so before that all happened, though, my mother saw through him. There was a point that came when she realized, I'm a puppet in his game. I'm a pawn in his game. He doesn't really care about me. He has some obsession with my daughter. Mm. And she didn't know there was anything sexual that had happened. Nothing like that. No one knows. My sisters, I don't tell my best friend. I don't tell anybody. I am completely on a mission to save a dying planet and don't want to be vaporized and don't want anything bad to happen to my family.
Right.
That's the truth.
Did anyone ask you?
Yeah, they sent me. I was court ordered to go to, I think it was court ordered to go to a psychiatrist and then a psychologist. But the interesting part about all those things that therapy like that is brand new. Yeah. There aren't even child abuse laws in place in every state. There has been, like, the federal level has said we have to have laws that protect children from abuse, but it was against the law to beat your animals and starve your animals before it was against the law to abuse your child.
Wow.
That didn't really happen. Every state had to adopt those laws and then figure out, what do we do? What's the punishment if they break the law? And then now therapy and that sort of thing is starting to happen, but obviously it's only been in the last, 10 years that we even, talk about mental illness and people don't, right. have that reaction of, oh, somebody's saying I'm crazy. This is the 70s. So as that unfolds, and my mother has several experiences with him where she realizes this, and then the hearing, and then he's got this sentence of 15 days. The whole time he's still grooming and brainwashing me. So I'm meeting up with him. I'm getting notes. He tells me to stage a fight with my parents. I haven't been, touchy feely with my dad, which was a complete 180 from the, from the childhood, loving my dad and mom, like they were the best, to not touching my dad and always avoiding him and never trying to avoid, any contact with boys, even at school, or just downplaying all those things so that I was safe to, for the male companion so we could finish the mission.
So so you weren't allowed to have like any contact with boys or men, or you would be vaporized?
That was one of the rules, okay. that Zeta and Zethra, and being who I was a part of that. Right. Mm-hmm. And so trying to live by all those rules perfectly so nobody got hurt, and then getting to the place of, okay, now this is what they've told us you need to do. You need to stage a fight with your parents, pack a backpack, write a note that I will give you what to write, which he did, and I copied it with all the misspellings, and I was a straight A student. So that's why my mother was like, this note isn't even Jan. I mean, it's her handwriting, but it's not her. She doesn't misspell words. She doesn't, this, the way she sounds, it's obviously she wrote this note under duress from Berchtold. They know that at this point. And then I left. I crawled out my bedroom window, the bedroom downstairs that he had divided into separate rooms. So I was at the very end of the house. And there were two little windows, and he built a hanging chair, this big flat velvet cushioned hanging chair that I could get up on and crawl out that window. And there he was to meet me and drive me to, he drove me to, Pasadena, California, and, school. This was August 10th, 1976. And school hadn't started, and he was enrolling me in a boarding school there. So I stayed with a family that apparently the nuns at the boarding school had helped him find a family for me to stay at. And then they put me in the boarding school when it was appropriate, a little later in August. And I started school, and the nuns thought that he was a CIA agent, and that we had escaped from Lebanon, and that my mother had been killed in the Lebanon crisis.
Wow.
And he had all the credentials, and that he was good friends with Gerry Ford, the president. And they believed him. It's always the most powerful teacher is the first one. That's why it's so important as parents, how we teach our kids before somebody else tells them something else, anyway, that was the way it went. And I went to a boarding school. I learned all the prayers. I knew the rosary. I went to mass every morning before our classes. I had a sweet roommate from Japan. Jacinta Lobo was her name. I want to find her. I wonder if she's still somewhere that I could talk to her. And she was so kind. She didn't speak a lot of English, but these are just little Easter eggs in my story.
Yeah.
I remember notes and letters that even when they found me finally almost 4 months later and brought me back home, she would write letters that she missed me.
Aww.
And she was just a sweet,
what a precious person.
I know.
He told you that one of the teachers at the school was an alien.
Yeah. He told me that one of the teachers there was just, they look like us, but it's funny how your mind will fill that in. Didn't tell me which one, but I knew which one. I could tell from their eyes. I could see aliens everywhere. He never was allowed back in our home after the first kidnapping. My father wouldn't allow it at all. My father saw through him, not that he was a sexual predator, but he saw through him and then made sure that he was, kept saying he can't be a part of our lives. But like I said, here's all this family that we've been so close to back at church. They still live a block away from us.
It was only a block. Just a final comment on the previous thing is that the therapy, like finding all these excuses to lie in your bed, but it's on top of the covers and the door is open and it's only 20 minutes or whatever. That is the perfect example of how you groom a family to get comfortable with them being close to your child. Back to, so now you're in California. You're in Pasadena. Do you miss your family?
I miss them so much, but I am on this heightened state of awareness that I will never be able to be with them until the mission is accomplished. I mean, there's that thing that's like, if I ever get to go back home and go back to my normal life, I have to have this baby to save the dying planet. So I am hyper vigilant that, you know, that happens, that we're working on that, that I'm excusing every bit of abuse that's happening in as my little 14-year-old brain could do. I'm still prepubescent. I don't start that till I'm 17. I'm this little teeny person. So all of that is still happening. I'm still completely in it. Even when we're found the second time and I'm brought home, I still am just in a state of panic that how are we going to finish the mission? I'm still not pregnant. I'm not having the baby. I don't want this to happen to my little sister. I don't want Karen to go blind. I don't want my dad to die. There wasn't a specific threat against my mom. I'm not sure why. But anyway, that's how it was. And so even after coming back that second time, I was even more like a robot, more removed from everyone that I loved. But I missed my family and my best friend terribly. I was very homesick. And that's what happened was when he realized how homesick I was and he let me call home and just, again, to support the thing that I haven't seen be. I don't know where he is. I've run away. That's the story. So even with Birchtold, this story is, I don't know where she is. I've spoken to her a few times on the phone, but you know, she's living hard. She's on drugs. She's living with a cult. She's whatever. And my mom and dad are like, Jan, who cries if she has to get a shot, a vaccine or something, is not on drugs. They just know that he's full of shit.
Yeah.
But they are trying to keep him on the phone long enough. Maybe he'll say something. You know, my mom is like in charge of, you know, talk to him until she just loses it. And she's like, you need to tell us where she is. We know you have her, you know, we know. But he's like, how could I have her? I just served my 15 days in jail. And this is like a month after he takes me the second time. I'm already in Pasadena he goes to serve his 15 days. See, people don't get the timeline. Right. And we know that it's like the perfect excuse. How could I have done it? I'm serving my time in jail. He's got me holed up in this boarding school that the nuns think they're protecting me when the police and different investigators do come more than once before they actually go, oh my gosh, is what they're saying true? Is this girl that is here, is she really a kidnap victim? Is it? And then they finally tell them, yes, she is here. But it took more than one visit.
Wow.
Authorities before they believed them and not him, because he was so good at creating that world. Like if you tell people that she's here, there are people that are in disguise. They might come as
from the Iranian government, correct? Yes. Mm-hmm.
From the government. Yeah.
Wow. Holy shit.
So when they do finally come, does he get arrested?
Yes. Okay.
He is arrested. Yes, he does get arrested, and more quickly actually than the first time. In the course of months and how long it took, he pleads out and pleads mental defect, which my sister reminded me just last night. She's like, do you know that had just come into play, that mental defect was a new thing that people could plead? And so people are pleading this all over the place, and they don't even have all the rules in place or what it should be and what is true mental defect and what is just, I mean, anybody that commits crimes has some mental problem, you know, that hurts children. But what is true mental defect and what is just an excuse? And so, again, he pleads that. They take the plea because of everything that we had been through and so drawn out the first time. It's not my parents. It's the federal government, you know, and the state that are prosecuting. It's not my parents. And I don't think people get that either. Mm-hmm. It's different when it's a kidnapping case. And because I was listed as a runaway and because there were all these things like, how do we prove this? They took that plea and he's sentenced to go to a mental hospital, and everybody on, you know, the side of my parents and, you know, everybody thinks that he's going to go there for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. But 5 months later, he's fine and he's let out.
Unbelievable.
He's back in society. And that's the way that went. And so he's still not done with me. I mean, he's still getting notes to me. When he's first in jail, he's in jail with two arsonists who then burn my father's, he pays them to burn my father's business to the ground. This is after the second kidnapping.
Wow.
Of course, Jan thinks it's her fault because I must have done something wrong. And here we are standing outside in freezing cold in February of that year of 1977. This is, you know, he kidnaps me in early August. I'm brought home in November, right before Thanksgiving and Christmas, and he's in jail. And then he's in jail with some arsonists who then burn my father's store to the ground and 12 other businesses. A whole city block of Pocatello is burned to the ground.
Wow.
Downtown Pocatello, you know, the historic district of Pocatello, it goes up in flames because of him. But even that, he escaped that charge too. The two guys that actually lit the match, they went to jail, but he didn't.
Can you tell us how you finally realized that he was a fraud?
So what happened is the summer of my 16th birthday. So second kidnapping is year 14. I then turn 15 the next summer after being home for 6 months, 7 months. And then there's a whole other year that is going by. I'm about to turn 16 and he's been in touch with me all this time. I still believe it completely. Well, what happened was I went to a theater camp. That's the place that really saved my life. So I go to this theater camp, and during the camp, it's a 5-week camp. I'm going to be turning 16. And I know that that's D-Day. 16 is the day that I, if I'm not pregnant, having the child to save the dying planet, I will be vaporized.
Wow.
So that's what I'm carrying with me. But it's theater camp, the thing that I'm passionate about. I've been an actress since I was 6. Mm. And I love that because it's the place I could cry. It's the place I could scream. It's the place that I could be so not acting like everything was fine. It's where I did my therapy on stage. So there's this boy at the theater camp that follows me around. I have one scene with him in the play. You know, and I know he likes me, but I avoid him like the plague, other than when we're in our scene, because I can't talk to him. I can't have any kind of a relationship with him. So this is a couple weeks before my birthday. We're about 2 weeks into the camp, and we're at the bowling alley where there's ice cream, and he's in front of me in the line after rehearsal. We've all gone down there, this whole big group of kids, and he pays for my ice cream. I'm right behind him in the line, and I'm so stunned and mortified, I freeze like you do in trauma. And I eat the ice cream with the group. And then I just run back to my little dorm room. And I'm just sobbing on my bed and begging them, please don't hurt my family. Mm. I didn't know he was going to do that. You know, I'm just beside myself. You know, I'm pleading. And I'll do whatever you tell me. Please don't hurt my family. Well, nothing happened. Then about a week later, you know, my parents call me every night. There's a certain time, you know, between dinner and the rehearsal that they call me at my little phone on the wall in the dorm. And we talk. And my mom calls that night and we're talking and everybody's fine except the dogs. The dogs have maybe gotten some food poisoning or something. The one dog was having seizures. I took it to the vet and I'm just bawling. Oh my gosh. You know, knowing it's my fault. I must have done something else. And the dogs are now going to die. And my mom is like, oh, I think they're going to be fine. I'll call you in the morning, you know, which was not normal. So in the morning I'm by the phone, she calls and I talk to her and she says, I just wanted you to know that the dogs are fine. They're back home. They're doing well. They're acting normal. I think I might have fed them a little piece of meat or something that was a little too old. I think it was my fault. And I'm like, oh, okay. And everybody else is fine. Caroline's over. You know, her and Karen are really good friends now as well. And Susan's fine. Dad's gone to work. Everybody's okay. So there's number two experience within a short period of time. And what happened was, I call this my primary thought. For 5 seconds, I had the thought, okay, wait, are they real? Mm-hmm. Is this true? What I've been led to believe? And then the next 5 seconds, the secondary thought is, oh, I'm just kidding. I know you can read my mind. I'll do whatever you tell me. Please just don't hurt my family. Right. That's how brainwashing works.
Yeah.
And so that's what happened. I had that momentary thought. Well, I had this big plan. I knew that if I turned 16 and I wasn't pregnant, and this is my 16th birthday is coming up, that the ice cream happened and then the dog thing happened. And then my birthday is like in 5 days. Mm. Birchtold has contacted me. He's trying to find a way we can meet up. The day and time that we had thought we could meet up, I'm like, I can't. Now there's a rehearsal at that time. I have a buddy. I can't just disappear. So we didn't. So I have this plan that if I get to my 16th birthday, I'm going to tell Susan about the mission and what she has to do, because she's half alien and half human like me. And then
your sister,
if she doesn't want to do it, I'll kill her. And then I'll kill myself, because obviously killing myself is going to be better than being vaporized, which I figure is like being put in hot boiling water, or I don't know, something like that. That's my burning alive from the inside. I don't know what that means. I just know it's going to be worse than me going and finding my dad's gun, which I know he's now bought a gun and I know where it is. And I'll just take her out and then take myself out. Mm. And so my 16th birthday comes and all these friends at this camp have this surprise birthday party for me. And I'm enjoying all of that. But the background is this incessant, insane fear. And what happens is, after the day happens and birthday happens, and I'm laying basically on my bed in the dorm room thinking, okay, this is it. I'm going to be vaporized. I won't be here in the morning because I'm not at home to do the plan. Well, I wake up the next morning fully clothed and I'm like, am I still really here? You know, and all of a sudden there's another week of this camp, because that's when we're doing the show the next weekend, first week of August, and I'm alive. So I've still got this plan in my mind. I'm like, okay, are they for sure? Is this for sure real? Here's number three thought in my brain. We do the play. My family all comes. They take me home from BYU back to Pocatello. School starts. It's mid-August. And I'm testing the waters. Every day I'm doing something that was forbidden. Every day I'm talking to a new boy at school, or I'm just these little things that are piling up as evidence that this isn't real. The big test was me going to my first dance with a boy. I said yes to go to this dance. And I didn't really know the boy. He was one of my dearest friend's boyfriend's cousin. I didn't really know the boy, but she said, we are making you go to this dance. You have never been to a dance with any of us, and this is silly. You got to go to a dance. And so they get me to this dance. There's four couples, you know, this group of friends. And I come home from the dance and my dad's waiting up for me, sitting in his lazy boy chair where he always was at night, you know, and he's asleep and he wakes up when I come through the door and he's like, oh, Jenny, how was the dance? I mean, for them, this is my first dance. And I'm like, it was fun. It was good. And I barely talked to my dad for, you know, 3.5 years. I barely spoken to him, let alone let him touch me. And so I go sit on the arm of the lazy boy chair and we talk a little bit and then I give him a hug.
Wow.
I can't deal with it either.
I'm crying too. And I go walking down the hallway because I didn't sleep in that bedroom anymore. It was too terrifying for me. And I just told my parents, I have to sleep in the guest room. I need to be upstairs. I feel too far away from, you know, I don't know. I just made up some reason. And so I'd sleep either in my sister Susan's bedroom. She had a trundle bed. Or I'd sleep in the guest room, which was all on that same floor, right by my parents' room in a long hallway upstairs. And I went back to that guest room bed. And again, I laid on the top of my bed. I went past Susan's room. There she was asleep, fine. My mom was in bed asleep. My dad, I knew Karen was in her bed asleep. And I laid on the bed and I just, now what do I do? This isn't real. I'm pretty sure this isn't real. If I can go to a dance and on a date and dance with a boy and come home and everybody's still here and fine. So then you don't know what to do. Then you're kind of trying to deprogram yourself at 16 and a young 16. I haven't started puberty yet. I'm tiny. I'm not dumb. I'm a straight A student, but I'm not I've just missed out on developing naturally for 4 years of my childhood.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Who am I? I'm not this important person that has this mission to save this planet. That was a huge motivator to keep me sane in an insane way. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
How you put those things together. Mm-hmm. Who am I? What do I do now? Do I tell somebody? Will they think I'm stupid? Is it a delayed reaction? Maybe something really bad will still happen. But I'm pretty sure now with all these things. And he's already lost interest in me because he's already abusing his next victim.
Wow.
That's the woman I get to interview on the documentary.
Mm.
He's already picked her out. He's already got her mom in love with him. Already a member of the family.
Wow.
And he's divorced from his original wife, but she said, but we would do stuff with all the kids. She fit perfectly between the fourth and fifth child. You know, the first three were our ages, and she fit right in between in age of his last two children. There she is, 5 years later, already being manipulated and abused.
Mm.
And that's why he hadn't been around much. He tried to see me at the camp, but he didn't. And then he never was in contact with me until later. I mean, the guy was still obsessed on some level because he came in and out of my life several times later, which you see that in the documentary with the whole stalking injunction sitting in that courtroom. But it was, you know, some years. And even at college, he found where I lived and called me on the phone.
Wow.
But at that moment, you're just trying to know what you're supposed to do next.
That's
basically what happened. I started to, my sister Karen and my best friend Caroline, you know, shortly after that night of just laying there staring at the ceiling going, who am I and what do I do next? They started asking me questions. We started a conversation that led to this whole kind of outpouring of what had happened to me and, you know, clawing at the carpet and crying incessantly and screaming. And Karen, my sister, says it's one of the scariest things I've ever witnessed.
Mm.
It was like an exorcism of some sort or something that was coming out of me. And then eventually I told my parents, and I didn't talk in detail about the icky stuff. I just said those words. There was icky stuff, mm-hmm. and I don't want to talk about it. And to my parents' credit, as the years have gone on, they just listened to me then. They believed me. They never questioned me. They never blamed me. They just listened intently and believed me.
Mm.
That's what survivors need.
Yeah.
They need that one friend, that one person, and then they can get on their journey to healing. Is why I started the foundation.
Right. And another thing that you said that struck me was that your mom, you know, was never defensive. Because you got really angry looking back at what had happened, and she never justified herself. She never made excuses. She was like, I'm so sorry. Like, yep. That's so beautiful.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It really is amazing. Honestly, that is one of the most amazing qualities that both of my parents possessed, was this unconditional love and this ability to, all through the years, as something would come up, to just... My dad would often say, I learned more from my girls than I could have ever learned in college or in my life, than anybody in my life. That my girls, because we had such deep conversations with our parents as we became adults and would have these feelings or whatever. I don't know if Karen and Susan feel like they had the same degree of that as mm-hmm. I did, but I would call and say, I'm so angry with you. I lost these years. Why didn't you see? Why didn't you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, never defending themselves, just listening and saying, we're so sorry. We wish we would have known. We didn't know. You know, how can we help? Well, how can we support you? Do you need a therapist? Do you need something from us? We are here for you. That's what I got.
I think that is so, like, that being the response is such a rare mm-hmm. and impressive quality, because I mm-hmm. think it would just be so difficult. And we were just talking about how someone in my life had, you know, their parent was just in such denial and about something that had happened to them. And, you know, it's just like, it's just so psychologically difficult to accept that maybe you could have had played a part in your child being abused. I mean,
yeah,
it's so amazing. Yeah, it's devastating. And our brains, like, will try to think of ways that isn't true, and they make up excuses. So the fact that they were able to acknowledge it and take responsibility for it is, yeah, it's just incredibly impressive.
It's huge. It's what it is truly, like, the one thing that every survivor of any kind of trauma, I think, needs, is being able to tell their story and to be believed and not blamed in the slightest, not even an eyebrow raise. Mm-hmm. Like, to literally be listened to, believed, and not blamed is, like, the key. It is, like, people want to know, well, how did you heal? I'm like, this was the key to unlock that door to healing. Mm-hmm. And then I could go on. And if I'm stuck in my life, I describe my beautiful, perfect Camelot childhood, even all the years with the Birchtolds. It was Camelot. We were so safe. We were so loved. We were so happy. And then somebody takes that beautiful music on your beautiful record, and it's individual to you. Your music is your music. You are not like anybody else. Those grooves are your record. And they scratch that record. And I'm like, that scratch doesn't go away, but your ability to lift the needle over the groove, over the scratch at different times in your life is what you get good at. And it is possible to have a happy, healthy, hopeful, productive life post-trauma, but you will crash into that place where you're stuck. But what my parents provided was that thing of being believed and not having to defend themselves, just listening, gave me through those early 20s, in my 20s, and gave me that self-worth and esteem that you lose. You know, when you're abused, you lose that. You don't have that confidence that just came with being a child and running from one place to the next. You lose something that you can only get it back by on purpose, you know, movement forward. And they helped me get that back in my life to the point where I knew I was worth it every time I'd come to a groove that I was stuck. You know, I've been married and divorced several times, and they were always there to support me. They were never there to criticize me. They were always just, you know, your healing has its own path. And the journey that you take to learn things is going to have its own path. And so every experience in my life, I've been able to somewhat say, this was something that I needed to learn. And maybe I wasn't there yet to make a good choice in this area. Mm. And, you know, you get the help you need if you have enough confidence to think you're worth it. And that's really why I started the online community. And my foundation is that people need that, and not everybody gets it. Like you said, it's rare to get that, maybe from the most important people in your life, your parents or your partner, or the orbit that you are surrounded by, that it's grandpa, and he's the, and this is a true story, and he's the, you know, leading, he's a stake president and the leading attorney in our town, and a stake president is a big church leader in our church, and he's all these things. So that whole family system, when the one girl told, grandpa's revered, it all breaks down. Everybody's like, she's lying. That can't be true, because I loved grandpa. Well, it took three or four other girls from this same, you know, four children of grandpa who have children to come forward and say, it happened to me too. And still this poor 21-year-old that I was talking to, she's like, half my family still doesn't believe us. Mm. Luckily, my parents did believe me and believe my cousins. But it is so devastating to a family when someone that they love, trust, and certainly already think they know is doing this to their children to come to terms with it. And grandpa died before he could be prosecuted. But that's the outcome. We have to be able to help people have a community where they're believed first and foremost, so their stories can come out, and then to know what to do next. Agreed. What do you do next? Like me laying on that bed.
Yeah.
What do you do next?
What is your foundation's name?
The Jan Broberg Foundation.org. And I tell other survivor stories on my podcast, The Jan Broberg Show. And that's been a really wonderful journey for me to help others tell their story that are ready. So I want people to know about that. And then we have special guests that come on, and we'll talk about various, you know, tactics of grooming, or they'll talk about how you can eat healthier to help yourself, you know, mentally, physically are connected. And I mean, just various things trying to help the conversation be broader and further along than it usually is. Most people aren't really telling their stories for, you know, 10, 15, 25, 50 years later.
Yeah.
You know, I have people that are finally telling their stories, and whether it helps one other person identify that, oh, this really is abuse and I really should say something because my predator has probably gone on to prey on other people. I didn't know that. I didn't know he was going to have other victims when I was in my 20s.
Right.
But if I had known that and I had like made a police report, maybe when this happened to the next girl that I got to interview, he would have stayed in jail longer. Right. You know, she did have enough courage to tell a detective that they did convict him of rape of a child. But he only spent, I think it was 10 months in jail. If there had been two or three people that had reported in their adulthood, because there were girls before me and girls after me, but those before me, if we all had reported it, he would have stayed in jail longer. He would not have gotten out for, you know, in 10 months.
Yeah,
he would have spent the 10-year sentence in jail and would have prevented the two girls after her. That I know.
Community is so important. I mean, and that is exactly a great example of what you're talking about. I mean, people need to be able to find each other and get advice and get that help and find a supportive person or people.
Exactly. So that's the community aspect of the foundation, is really to be in the conversation with others who will support and believe you, and then to eventually be able to have, you know, methods of how do we really help in the legal advice that my parents didn't get? How do we help families that it's, you know, a loved member of the family prosecute? I had one lady that said, I finally gave up after 7 years. I needed my little boys to be their mother and help them move on. She of just course. Gave up. Of she course. Tried for 7 years to put, I think it was her brother behind bars for raping her two young sons. You know, for years, 3 or 4 years that it had happened. Wow. And now her boys are, you know, instead of being, you know, 5 and 8 or whatever they were at the time, now they're fast forward 5 more years. Now they're 13 and 15. And she's like, I have to be here for them. It was impossible to put him in jail.
Yeah.
We got to help. We remove people from society. Gotta help other people do this.
Yeah.
They just go on and perpetrate others.
Well, your story is so important in doing that, and we could not be more grateful for you sharing it with us.
Thank you so much for coming on. And tell us the name of the shows, docs, of all the things again.
My podcast series is called The Jan Broberg Show. The new book, where mom and I and my sisters all contributed to giving more details and more story. It's like a masterclass in grooming if you read the whole book, and it's a page turner. You can't put it down. It's my story, but really told really, really well. That's called The Jan Broberg Story. And then the foundation is The Jan Broberg Foundation.
Amazing.
So
awesome.
Just know my name and let me open up my heart to you and tell you, I'm so sorry to any listener that anything like this has happened to them. Because even though my story is like this crazy, fantastic story, the through line is that people are abused by someone they know, someone they often love and trust. Mm-hmm. And that is my message. We have to start telling those stories. They are the least prosecuted and they are the most common, you know, and I really am here to stand up for you and your own healing and to make a change through this awareness that I think we can gain by, you know, watch the series, watch the documentaries, watch the Peacock documentary that is kind of the last pieces of kind of my journey of healing and then what I'm doing today. And join me in spreading this message because it's so true. I'm really committed to your own health and happiness as well as my own.
Totally. Well, thank you so much. You're amazing. I admire so like that you've been able to tell this story for so long, and it's really getting hard now. And I just think that it's really awesome and you are making a difference. And it's called Friend of the Family, True Evil on Peacock.
That's right. Let's move into the next part. Let's change this craziness.
Let's do it.
Thank you so much for the time.
So I'm just going to generally comment on the thing we were kind of mentioning in the intro, which is like how small or silly the straws that finally break the camel's back can be. I always think about our dear friend Jatarth, who, you know, it was just like he realized that Q was manipulating him because of just like some silly phrase that Trump had already been saying that was, you know, Q foretold that he would say. For me, I think that like my overall like Mormonism, you know, loss of faith had so much to do, similar to Jan, with just like boys and like different, obviously, because it wasn't like there wasn't a particular like person who was kind of leading my ideology at that point, because the cult stuff had happened when I was younger. But it was like losing my virginity that really like made me be like, oh, I don't think I'm Mormon.
Yeah.
And so much. And Moses too, I feel like he like liked a girl. Moses Storm liked a girl at the store.
That was such a romantic story. Second episode of Trust Me. Yeah. They worked at a grocery store together. It's true romance. I love
it. Yeah, it's funny. Like just having a crush on someone can change everything.
Yeah.
You know?
Love.
And fucking can really change everything.
It's true. It's true.
Did you feel like you had any like little moments like that kind of changed your outlook?
I would say more just talking to people who have a different understanding of the stuff I was taught. They were taught it a little bit differently. It's always interesting to get other people's takes on stuff.
That it is.
Thank you so much for being here with us. We can't wait to see you again next week. And as always, remember to follow your gut, watch out for red flags, and never ever
trust me. And happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. Bye.
Bye.
Trust Me is produced by Kirsten Woodward, Gabby Rapp, and Steve Delamater.
With special thanks to Stacey Para.
And our theme song was composed by Holly Amber Church.
You can find us on Instagram at Trust Me Podcast, Twitter at Trust Me Cult Pod, or on TikTok at Trust Me Cult Podcast.
I'm Ula Lola on Instagram and Ola Lola on Twitter.
And I am Megan Elizabeth 11 on Instagram and Babraham Hicks on Twitter.
Remember to rate and review and spread the word.